Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on discovering the first galaxies right after this message. Well, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed this scriptural advice when they put into our federal Constitution, at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. Now, in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. Now, in the intervening 70 years, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're now the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here at the law school. To learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. The Business and the Mosaic Law Schools are both available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the origin of the universe, talking about galaxies. I read you the story out of the February 2003 National Geographic magazine. I mean, these people speak with authority. They've got degrees after their names. They've got letters after their names. These people are important heavy hitters. And I pointed out that in comparison with the biblical account, I mean, after all, if we compare statements like, "Imagine a universe with no stars, no galaxies, and no light. Just a black brew of primordial gases immersed in a sea of invisible matter. Beginning a few hundred thousand years after the blinding flash of the Big Bang, the universe plunged into darkness that lasted almost a half a billion years." Talk about prose now. I mean, that sounds authoritative, doesn't it? Now, when we compare that with this inept statement in Genesis chapter 1, I mean, after all, this is pretty sick, isn't it? It says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light." Sounds kind of Dr. Seuss-ish, doesn't it? But then you got to understand that God didn't have a computer to write on, and he didn't have a degree from the colleges and universities of modern science today. Yes, it's true. The God of creation, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Moses, has no letters after his name. Well, as opposed to Dr. Abel, you know, and Dr. Spinrod, and Dr. Steve Dawson, and Theodore Lyman, physicists, graduate students, astrophysicists. You know, these are pretty high-powered people. Well, we've only got two choices. We can either go with Genesis 1, or we can go with the Big Bang. Now, I said that the Big Bang in the article in the National Geographic magazine had exactly three scientific statements in the entire article. 28 pages, 11 pages of text, three actually verifiable scientific statements. That's it. That's it. The rest of it is science fiction, pure and simple. But it's good science fiction. It's written with authority. And besides that, the only other alternative is special creation with God. So I thought, well, the burden's on me. You know, I said that last time. I said, hey, look, I think I can prove that the Bible account is scientific, that Genesis 1 and 2 is scientific, verifiable, and we can prove it in the laboratory. And National Geographic, the Big Bang with the dark matter. Remember? Dark matter, the stuff that we've never seen. We know it's there. It has to be there in order for our theory to work. Of course, we've never seen it. You can't get a bucket of it. You can't bring it in the laboratory, and you can't work on it. That's not science, boys and girls. Science has to be repeatable. Science has to be demonstrable. So I went back to this old-timey text. It's called A Harmony of Science and Scripture, written by Dr. Harry Rimmer. Dr. Harry Rimmer. One of those PhDs. Only Dr. Rimmer has a degree in science. Several sciences, as a matter of fact. He was a college professor. He believed in the Genesis chapter 1 account. He's one of those 44%. One of the minority now. Outranked by 6 percentage points. He's one of the minority. But that's a pretty sizable minority. Scientists today are divided into two camps, just like people. You got religious people. They believe in Genesis chapter 1. They don't know why and can't prove it, but they believe it. And then you've got evolutionary philosophers. They've been to college. They've been to, and they teach in your public schools, and they believe in the theory of evolution. They can't prove that either, but they believe it. Religious people and evolutionary people are religious. They've got one common denominator. They all have, as an article of faith, a belief in something that they can't prove, don't have any evidence for, and couldn't find it at high noon with both hands on a road map. But they believe it. Now, Dr. Rimmer wrote a neat book back in 1936 called A Harmony of Science and Scripture. Let's take a look here at Modern Science and the First Fundamental. Let's take a look at the first fundamental in science. Here's what Rimmer has to say. He said, every generation not only faces its own problems and difficulties, but it also erects its own standards of values and judgment. So the average man of the 20th century has a new measure by which he computes the value of all things material, philosophical, or spiritual. Being taught from early childhood to think largely in the terms of science, it is inevitable that modern man should reply to every problem which challenges his interest. What does science say on this subject? Now, in these most stirring and fascinating days of renewed inquiry, when all of the old things are being weighed once again in new scales, it's only natural that the judgment of science will be sought even upon the basic premises of our religious philosophy. In the minds of past generations, it would have been totally impossible to raise this question of the scientific evaluation of spiritual things, as it was the general opinion in the ages that has closed that the Bible was the final authority in all matters and subjects of all discussion. Our generation, in turn, has raised the fetish of science, to which we bow down and worship with a blind faith, unknown to the credulous age that is commonly called the age of Bible believers. Reverence has not been displaced in the hearts of men. It has rather sought a new object for its veneration. So in that sturdier generation, when a more robust faith ruled the minds of men who had not yet bent the knee to Baal, the Baal of supposed scholarship and prejudicial research, this question would never have been considered, and this chapter would never have been written. But I must hasten to remark that we in no wise regret the new order or the present age. The contrary is rather the fact. If the Bible is true, if the Bible is true, and if its revelations are indeed from Almighty God, the God, I mean the actual creator of the universe, then we ought not to have any fear to have it tested by any standard of truth that is honest and that is established. If the words of the great book are not in full accord with all known fact, then we've been mistaken in calling it the Word of God. Instead of the Word of God, it should be a philosophy book. Now, we use the word fact in its accepted meaning, as distinct from theory and unproved hypotheses. Our main objection to the pseudo-scientific philosophy of this present generation is that it manifests an amazing willingness to surrender the eternal verity of God's revelation for the unfounded theories propounded by men who are utterly without ability to prove their wild imaginings. And science, we must repeat, is a correlated body of absolute knowledge. The accumulation of reliable scientific knowledge is a gradual and a slow process. The trial and error method is perhaps the most prominent in all scientific techniques. Generation after generation discards the conclusions of their predecessors until finally a new stratum is laid upon the slowly accumulating pyramid of absolute and unquestioned and unquestionable fact. Now, the book which we call the Bible has remained unchanged and undeviating for thousands of years. Its writers never contradict one another, and all of its contents has an unwavering unanimity upon every subject introduced into its marvelous pages. We are perfectly willing to have the contents of this book tested by science as by any other established standard. And we should unhesitatingly state that when men of science agree unanimously upon any correlated body of facts and do not change their conclusions or agreements concerning these facts for several thousand years, we should then be willing, if necessary, to discard the Bible and to accept the conclusions of these new, venerable scientists and accept their conclusions instead. Now, we think that this is but an honest test, since the Bible rests upon that pedestal of millenniums, thousands of years of unchanging and unvarying agreement. Sometimes we're forced to realize that we live in an age which, priding itself upon the term scientific, is extremely superficial in many of its philosophical conclusions. Let me give you an illustration. The author would recount an experience that occurred when he was delivering a course of addresses at one of our colleges after one particular lesson. We were approached by a young student who desired to enter into a discussion concerning origins. And this young student began by saying, "Well, I would like to talk to you in the language of science. In this interview, I hope we can confine ourselves to scientific facts and language and get to the bottom of this question that I desire to ask you. Well, of course, we were more than willing to meet this young man upon his chosen grounds. Our early days in the study of medicine were spent learning double-jointed 12-cylinder knee action words, and we felt that if he wanted to speak exclusively in the weird and compound verbiage of science, we should be happy to accommodate him. We felt that the discussion promised much. So the young man opened the conversation by saying, "Where did the world come from?" To this, the writer replied, "Now let us be scientific, young man. What do you mean by world? Do you mean this planet, the solar system, the sidereal system, the universe, the cosmos? Just exactly what is it that you're asking?" In some surprise, the boy hesitated and then, with an embarrassed smile, replied with an expressive wave of his hands, "I mean the whole damn blame shooting match." So we laughed and said, "Well, that's not scientific, but it is very clear. You wish to know where the cosmos came from." And he said, "All right, if that's the word I want, where did the cosmos come from?" And I replied, "It was created." The young man asked, "By whom or by what?" And I responded, "By God," was my simple and sincere reply. "Who or what is God?" he asked. So I looked at him closely to be sure that he was really in earnest with his question, and I saw at least that he thought that he was thinking, and even that attitude on the part of a student is one to be encouraged. So I answered, "God is the deity who made all things. You may call him first cause, logos, personified power, or whatever else you wish. The point is, behind the appearance of the cosmos, there remains a person who is the author of all created things. He is life inherent." "All right," he said, "we'll pass that for a moment and ask this. Who made God?" So I answered, "Nobody made God." "Now, you're not being scientific in your language," he said. We said that God was life inherent. In the universe, there are but two types of life. Creature life. Life is life that is transmitted. The life of deity is life that is inherent, thus establishing by existence, per se, a creator. Now, we said that he was self-existent, and there is no other term for an infinity that is personified, that is more expressive than an inherent being. God always was, for there could be no beginning to deity. "Oh, come," he said, "I can't accept that. You know it's not scientific." So I said, "Well, I'm sorry that you can't see that, but that's the best I can do. Now let me ask you something, young fella." To which we would like to have a scientific answer. "Where do you think the cosmos came from?" "Oh," the young man responded, "it was evolved." To which I said, "Well, out of what?" And he said, "Out of a nebulous mass of gaseous matter." Well, fortunately, I'd read this same textbook, so we were prepared to ask, "Well, where did this nebulous mass of gaseous matter come from?" And the young man frowned in puzzlement for a moment, and he said, "Oh, I guess you would say that was created." So I said, "Well, I'm through talking now. Where do you say that it came from?" "Well, I will concede that the original mass of vapor was created." To which I said, "Well, by whom or by what was it created?" And he said, "By nature." "Very well, then. Who or what is nature?" I asked. Well, he hesitated for a moment, and he said, nature. Nature is the, nature is what we mean when we say nature." So I said, "Well, I'm afraid that's not very scientific, nor is it very clear. I do not know nature. just who is nature? Well, he responded, nature is the first cause of everything. It's the primary beginning. So I asked, well then, who made nature? And when did nature begin? And the lad flung open his hands in despair at my stupidity, and he said, nobody made nature at any time. Nature always was. So I laughed and said, well, I'm sorry. I cannot accept that. It is not scientific. Now, there we parted company, both of us having been talking about the same identical person or force under two different names. The man who thinks his way through the mechanics of creation will find behind all created matter a personified being of intelligence. Somebody with power. We hang a label on this intelligence and we call him God. We even go so far as to call him or he and talk of him in the male gender. Now, the man who is content to be superficial and only dimly grasp at the appearance of reason, reason behind matter, is content to say nature and then pass on. But unfortunately, in such discussions as the foregoing, a vital law of logic is being disregarded here, or it's being violated here. As Dr. Harris Gregg has so thoughtfully reasoned, it is a simple and profitable matter to discuss problems of origin with any person who has in his philosophy and in his logic an A and a Z. Now, by A, we mean that point beyond which a man's mind cannot reason in the direction of beginnings, so we have to start with something. And whatever it is that we start with is what we refer to as A. Now, the Z in the alphabet of logic is that point in the future beyond which the mind cannot travel with clarity. And we have to stop somewhere, so the stopping point is our Z. Now, it's totally impossible to have a logical discussion without first announcing the A and the Z. It's only possible to think in a straight line. So if we think between two objectives, the man who seeks to reason without an A and without a Z in the alphabet of his logic reminds us of a playful Airedale dog who for many years was our favorite companion and friend. And this dog was very fond of exercise and fun. And if there was nobody around to play with, he had a game that he played in solitude. He'd start after his tail. He'd go around in a circle like a man reasoning with no A and no Z. The dog, however, had one advantage. As he went around and around in these endless circles, he was careful to keep his eye on his end view. Now, the man, however, who reasons this way has no end to keep in view, and his mental exercise is more fruitless than the physical exercise of a dog chasing his tail. So this writer would be careful to announce that as he starts on his pilgrimage of philosophical reasoning, he begins with God. Then he has thought his way as far back in the nebulous dimness of the beginning of all things as a mind can feel its way, and he starts with a God already existent and unlimited in power. Back of God we cannot go. Now, of course, we cannot think before him who is infinite and eternal. In our philosophy, he is the very start of timeless age and eternal beginnings. So when we have journeyed as far down the vista of the future as the human mind can go, we end with God. And after all, the human mind can only stagger on its questing way as far into the coming eternities as it can envision God. So in our philosophy, deity is the beginning and the end for us, our Alpha and Omega, the starting point and the termination as well. Having then settled for the sake of clarity the fact that we must in logic begin with God, we will turn to the realm of logic and science to see if his person can be demonstrated by independent external evidence called science. Now, the first fundamental of the Christian faith is this, that God is a person. The fact of deity is universally conceded by all save the fool who has said in his heart, there is no God. This traditional and foundational tenet of all faiths is found in false and true philosophies alike. Even those who would becloud the issue with nebulous evasions of fact speak of the existence of a deity, even though they postulate it as some ethereal and unknowable force or principle. The Christian revelation, however, goes right to the heart of the matter with a plain enunciation of the most vital fact in the thought of the human race, namely, there is a God who is a person. We get that from the Bible, the Hebrew book, allegedly written by this deity that Christians call God. Now, this was the reason for the coming of Christ. Jesus clothed himself in human flesh that he might manifest God. He stated that the purpose of his coming was that he, Jesus, might show forth God, the only begotten Son who was in the bosom of the Father from eternity, clothed himself with a temporal existence that he might teach this reality. The personality, the certainty of God's being, and upon the foundation of the personality of God, the entire scriptural structure rests. Turning then to the realm of science and reason, we see that the basic foundational facts of science might say as to the existence of God, we will appeal to an unvarying law of logic. And this law is, when you begin with a fact that is universally conceded and reason from that fact to your conclusion. So at the start of this investigation, we should ask the reader to grant a concession. That concession being granted, we will demonstrate each successive step as we press on to the scientific evaluation of the credibility and the reality of the existence of God. Now, the concession that we desire is simply this, that you and I agree that there is a cosmos. This fact, no reasoning mind can deny. The universe is real. The solar system is concrete. The planet on which we live, and which is the source and scene of most of our scientific investigation, is a stubborn, indisputable, unchanging, irrefutable fact. Now, then, beginning with the certainty of the fact of the cosmos, we will raise the eternal question, whence? Where did it come from? We do not live in a world made up of a single ball of solid matter. We're part of a very marvelous and complex system. Not only does the sun, which is the source of our earthly light, revolve as the nucleus of a solar system, but this system is itself part of a universe. This universe, in turn, is one of many such that make up the physical cosmos. We are a tiny but integral part of a complex physical creation. 350 million solar systems are reported within their suns, planets, and satellites in our galaxy, the Milky Way. Then, beyond all this, the spiral nebulae are seen as silver snails in the Garden of God, and each of them being so vast in diameter that they are at present beyond the reach of our counting devices. Suffice it to say that there are billions upon billions of these solar systems, in billions of billions of galaxies. Now reason doth rear her head and cry. Here it is. Here's this marvelous and amazing cosmos. So accurate is our solar system that we measure time by the revolution of the planets and their moons around the sun. Now, it's kindergarten logic to reply that you cannot get more out of anything than you have previously put in. So we think it will be conceded as a principle that out of nothing, you get nothing. And also out of something, you get no more than that thing is able to contain. You cannot take a gallon of milk out of a pint bottle. Well, unless you refill the bottle again and again. You cannot put $100 in the bank and take out $1,000. The man who seeks to take out of the bank far more than he put in will find himself a more or less grateful recipient of free board and room for many months to come. This, then, is a fundamental point of logical reasoning. We recognize that out of nothing, nothing comes. Now, add to that what Hull of Dartmouth, what Hull calls the fundamental law of physics, and this expresses the case perfectly in scientific terms. This law may be stated in these words. All transformations of matter that result in the production of energy are a result of degeneration, a breaking down from the complex to the simple. We call these the two basic laws of thermodynamics. Now, as an illustration of this unquestionable scientific fact, we would introduce the complex, highly organized material that is called petroleum. This petroleum is put through what is called a cracking process. This process results in the degeneration or breaking down of the original mass into its simpler component parts. Out of the complex mass called petroleum, an almost innumerable list of substances can be derived. Things like kerosene, benzene, gasoline, and various grades of lubricating oils, and Vaseline and greases, all produced in the breaking down and the shattering of the amazingly complex structure of petroleum. Now, one of these simpler ingredients we call gasoline. This gasoline is introduced into a manifold which gasifies the substance, in which form it is put into the cylinder of an internal combustion engine. This compressed matter is energized by an electrical spark and is further degenerated by an explosion in the course of its final destruction by flame. Power is imparted to the piston of the engine, and the exhaust gases are wasted out upon the atmosphere. Now, through this process of degeneration, however, power and motion are created. So then, in all of the physical universe, all motion, power, and energy are the result of degeneration. In the entire universe, the opposite process is never seen. Nowhere in physics do we see a natural tendency to build up from the simple to the complex. Therefore, Hull's conclusion is that no matter what your theory of creation may be, you have to start with a universe that's already charged with a tremendous amount of high-grade energy, like a clock that's been wound up and started, and it has been running down ever since. Now, in the light of this view of the universe, the logical question to ask is, who wound it up? Now, the clearest discussion of this problem of the whence of physical matter was presented to us one evening by a little fellow, a little lad who perhaps did not realize that fools may ask questions that the wise cannot answer. Well, in this case, however, he challenged our interest by the rather abrupt query, in all the whole world, how many different kinds of things are there? Pretty good question, wouldn't you say? in all of the world, how many different kinds of things are there? Well, his mother interrupted to say, well, you don't need to answer that question, doctor. I didn't know what he was going to ask you, but we said that we would like to try to answer that question. So turning to the little fellow, I said, well, Freddie, I don't know much, but I happen to know that in all of the whole world, the heaven and the earth, all of the stars and suns and moons and planets, there are less than 100 different things. The lad looked at us in amazement, and he said, ah, you must be spoofing me. I know there are more than 1 million because I know 1 million different things myself. Now, matching his seriousness with a like mean, we replied, now let's examine this and let's see, Freddie. You can't know 1 million different things because in all of the universe there are only 98 different things which are called elements. So the lad shook his head with stubbornness and he said, well, I know there are more than that. Well, entering into the spirit of the argument, we said, well, all right, well, what is one of those things that you know? Being in sight of the supper table, he said, well, salt's one thing. I said, well, that was an easy one. He said, no, Freddie, salt is not one thing. Salt is two things. Somebody has taken a piece of metal called sodium and a piece of gas called chlorine and mixed the two things together. The result is what chemists call sodium chloride. And we common folks simply call it salt. But salt is not one thing. It's two things in combination. How about water? That's one thing. No, water is two things. Two pieces of a gas called hydrogen and one piece of a gas called oxygen. When we mix them together, they make water. How about air? Isn't that just one thing? Wrong again. Air is always three things. 79 pieces of a gas called nitrogen mixed with 21 pieces of a gas called oxygen and a tiny portion of carbonic acid gas makes up the simplest kind of air. Air isn't one thing. It might be as many as 12 or 14 things, depending on how close you live to a glue factory or a garbage dump. Well, the boy laughed with keen appreciation, and he said, well, I think I see. It's kind of like arithmetic or like the alphabet. And that's the perfect figure of creation. The whole world of mathematics resolves itself into two divisions. First, we have the factors that men call the numerals. These factors are figures from 1 to 9, and then we add a cipher added for convenience in multiplication. With these 10 factors combined with intelligence, we can solve the problems of mathematics and arrive at the solution of the most intricate of these problems. Mathematics, then, are predicated first upon factors and secondly upon intelligence to manipulate those factors. The science of figures would be totally impossible without intelligence of a high order, capable of making absolutely innumerable combinations of the few factors. The universe, then, is a combination of factors on purely mathematical formulae. These factors number 98. But factors alone cannot be resolved into mathematics. Intelligence is the more important element in the juggling and arranging of these factors. The entire physical creation is a solved problem in mathematics. For these various elements are combined in different proportions to make up all of the intricacy of the physical creation. Now, the same thing is true in the world of literature. In the English language, we have 26 factors called the alphabet. When these 26 letters are manipulated by intelligence of a sufficiently high order, literature is the result. The 26 factors by themselves remain dead. When they're combined by intelligence into orderly sequences, they then become a Gettysburg Address or a 23rd Psalm. These same factors may be framed by intelligence into a message to Garcia, or they may declare war upon some foreign power. Again, they may be recast into treaties of peace and documents of eternal fidelity. But no matter what the purpose and intent of the expressions of literature may be, there can be no literature until there is intelligence directed to the manipulation of the factors. Now, the creator of the universe has as the basis of his mathematics 98 figures instead of 10. These figures may be arranged and rearranged again and again into all of the marvelous and ponderable structures that we call the physical universe. Or shall we say that the creator has as his alphabet of creation 98 letters at his disposal. As an illustration of this, let me take one small series of alphabetical symbols and put them together in this form. S-T-A-R, star. The connotations of that resembling or assembling of factors are very definite and concrete and real. Those four symbols, those four letters, thus arranged, open to us all of the unfathomable vistas of the realm called astronomy. Now, without changing the value of those factors, we rearrange them into new positions and put them in this order. R-A-T-S. At once, the mind is struck with the ludicrous nature of this contrast. There is as wide a difference between the orbs of sidereal space and the rodents of a dark and gloomy basement as there is between any two extremes that the human mind can frame. But we have expressed those two extremes by our intelligence through a simple rearrangement of those four factors. Once more, we can arrange this figure, and now it is A-R-T-S. In this new order, these tiny creatures spring into our intelligence with all of the world of beauty and wonder that is open to the finer side of human nature. Herein, we have music and sculpture, painting and drama, poetry and prose, and all of the finer things that make life worthwhile. Again, we can recast these four symbols and they become TARS, T-A-R-S. Can there be a wider gulf in the meaning of words than that which exists between the black, foul-smelling, viscous masses that form the TARS and the ethereal kinetic view and value of the realm of the arts? So with this one simple demonstration, which might be multiplied into 1,000, I'd like to show that intelligence by the use of the same identical factors may express widely divergent conceptions. So to apply our illustration, one of the factors in creation is a little letter or symbol called carbon. When the atom of carbon is arranged in a sentence of creation so that each atom is touched at every point by four other atoms, that word spells diamond. Now, as we did in the case of the little word star, S-T-A-R, we now rearrange the relationship of the atoms of carbon one to another, and changing the pattern a little, a little word becomes graphite. The first substance we wear on our person with pride and enjoyment as the highest and richest adornment that a person can afford. The second we use in our lead pencil to record our casual and passing fancies. Diamonds and graphite are both made out of carbon. Once again, we rearrange the order of this element and it becomes coal to burn in our furnace. We change it again and it becomes clay. It becomes the substance out of which dishes and pottery may be made. We may then resolve our conclusion into this very simple phrase. The physical creation that we observe, that we see, that we touch, is a mathematical organization of certain factors combined upon known and tested formulae. So this raises the next question in the realm of logic. Who or what is this combiner? Now, there are surprisingly few answers to this question that reason can even ponder. There's only one answer that reason can accept. Only the thoughtless and those who are totally lacking in logic can reply chance is the combiner of the factors of creation. The statement that life began with a fortuitous combination of accidental circumstances and started a process of development and gradual change is not acceptable to a thinking and reasoning person. Since the factors of the physical structure are known, and since we recognize the fact that they cannot be manipulated without intelligence into the mathematical formulae and combinations of geometric intricacy, chance is totally ruled out. Now, we might as well say that success in solving mathematical problems depends upon luck. How many times would it be necessary? Let us say, how many times would it be necessary to cast the 10 factors of mathematics from a dice box onto a table before accident arranged these little symbols into the proper answer to a problem in higher mathematics? The solution of a problem in calculus would not be arrived at in 100 million years of incessant casting forth of the factors of that problem if the entire matter were left to chance. Can chance solve an equation? Can chance add a simple column of figures? Can chance multiply seven figures by six figures and find the right combination or solution? If mathematics depended upon luck or accident, we're very sure that many of us would have had better marks in school. Whatever else our conclusion may be concerning the origin of matter, we may well rule out the theory of chance. And we may as well say that literature is the product of chance as to ascribe creation to that source. How many times do you suppose we would have to put the 26 elements of the English language into a hat and shake them out onto a table before they would shape themselves into an Evangeline or fall accidentally into the arrangement of a Midsummer Night's Dream? The suggestion is utterly preposterous. Chance is ruled out. So who then is the combiner? Who or what is the intelligence that puts these 98 elements together and turns it into the cosmos? Seeking to evade the only logical conclusion, another man may say, recognizing that the universe is a combination of known factors, we believe that law is the combiner. Well, I would like to say, or I would like to be the last to deny the presence of law in the natural universe. And I'd like to point the reader's attention, however, to the fact that law is predicated upon two postulates. There's no law without a legislator or a legislature. The first requisite for law is the presence of a body or the presence of a being of sufficient authority to enact the law and to enforce it. Law, however, remains inactive until there is, secondly, a police power of sufficient authority to enforce the law that's been enacted. Occasionally, we have been in desert places where there is no law. The only guide for conduct was the desire of the individual, because there was no person, there was no body, there was no authority over that sphere, or none within sufficient reach to enforce the nominal authority. The only law was the ability of the individual to enforce his own paramount desires. It might be said that in those regions, the law consists of six statutes bound in one volume by the Colt Manufacturing Company. The only court of appeal was Judge Winchester, carried in the arm of the appellant. This condition is possible only where there is no organized body with authority to enact and enforce the law of that land. Now, when a wilderness is too far removed from the governing authority, laws may not be enforced therein. So again, I say that it may not be questioned that there is law in the physical universe, and that such law is implacably enforced, and there is a law of gravity. If you break the law of gravity, an injury will follow without mercy. And the judgments of the cosmos, when its laws are broken, are instant and inescapable. These laws speak with clarion tongue of a great power who has enacted these laws and keeps them in force. What is this power, and where does it come from? Where is the origin of its authority? Is it derived from the consent of the governed, the universe? Not at all. Natural law is extraneous to the universe that it governs. There's no greater or more logical argument for the existence of dominating intelligence behind creation than the very fact of law in the universe. Law, however, is a creature, and it's never a creator. Therefore, when we seek for the personality of the combining agency that has wrought this stupendous creation out of 98 elements mathematically aligned, the term law will not satisfy the truly logical inquiry. Some seek to find an easy way out by the use of the nebulous term nature, as did the student whose conversation we recorded at the beginning of this chapter. We recognize the existence of the world of nature and believe that we can later offer a definition of the word nature that will meet with the acquiescence of the thoughtful reader. It cannot, however, be advanced that nature is a creator. Nature is itself a postulate. The only truly great scientist who ever sought seriously to define nature begins his definition with the very familiar statement, "Nature is that blind, unreasoning force that creates without intelligence, and thus disqualifies nature as a creator." Can we have creation without intelligence? Can we have automobiles without intelligence, without engineers, without assembly line workers to manufacture the parts and put them together? When the parts of an automobile will produce themselves and assemble themselves into a finished and perfect car without any aid or direction. We can have creation without intelligence when an airplane will put itself together and fly across the Atlantic with no human help or guidance, or when a giant bridge builds itself across some vast chasm without the aid of engineers and mathematicians, when it just happens accidentally. By chance. Now, why will the human mind always seek to evade an issue that does not coincide with its individual prejudices? The clear-cut issue that we face here is the fact of a mathematical problem solved by intelligence in the vast realm of the cosmos. If the universe is a combination of these 98 elements, and we have the courage to face the issue squarely, we see that intelligence is as much demanded as are the physical factors themselves. Now, it's impossible to postulate intelligence apart from personality. We cannot logically conceive of intelligence as a sort of gas permeating the ether of space. Intelligence not only must be personified, it also must be localized. To meet this issue squarely, and to set the matter clearly before the reader, I would suggest this resulting equation. Matter equals creation. Creation equals intelligence. Intelligence equals personality, and personality equals God. Let me give that to you again. To meet this issue squarely and to set the matter clearly before you, the reader, we would suggest this resulting equation. Matter equals creation. Creation equals intelligence. Intelligence equals personality. And personality equals God. Now that's all that we started to show. Logic demands the existence of an intelligent personified being. Whether we call him God or Allah or Yahweh or nature or something else, there's intelligence there. Simply and clearly, men of courage face the issue squarely and confess this fact. Beyond and behind the mathematical perfection of combinations that constitute the universe that we can all observe, there is a person whom we call deity. What do you want to call it? Evolution? You want to call it blind chance? The Golden Gate Bridge didn't build itself. It didn't just happen. We didn't just happen upon California, sail into the San Francisco Bay and say, wow, look at that bridge from the peninsula over to Marin County. It just evolved. That's preposterous. It took intelligence. It took mathematics. And it took a lot of people, some time, through expense, to create that bridge. Creation demands a creator, no matter what you call him. But it's not blind chance. Thus, logic demands this very personality that the scripture describes and that the evidences of science attest, that the visible things of creation have ever argued to the logic of thinking creatures, the existence of an invisible creator. This conclusion we cannot escape. So the next query has to be, well, does science sustain what logic establishes? And indeed it does. And we believe that this is a statement that is very easy to establish. Well, I'm about out of time. We'll have to come back and take up the next portion of this query into creation. Where did the universe come from? National Geographic calls it discovering the first galaxies. Well, let's take a look at where these galaxies came from next time. On the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website. All right, I'm out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So, until then, God willing, good night, friends.